Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty together again. That little nursery rhyme describes a lot of different things, but in some ways it describes the sporting story of 2009 and 2010. That sporting story really isn't about sports, it's about a sportsman by the name of Tiger Woods. As probably most of you know and have heard all the reports, at the in November around Thanksgiving, became apparent that Tiger Woods had multiple affairs, and this sports icon had this meteoric fall from public grace. And as we're here in September of 2010, it's hard to know whether all the media moguls and everyone else will be able to put his image back together again. Chances are it'll never be quite the same. At the same time, just a month and a half or so before Tiger's fall, some of you will remember what happened with David Letterman. As Letterman was about to be extorted by someone who had found out about some affairs that he had, he came public with the fact that this media personality had had affairs with a number of the staff with whom he worked. By David Letterman's own admission, what he did was creepy. And yet, in September of 2010, that's almost been forgotten. Life has gone on for David Letterman, and yet Tiger Woods is still very much in the woods. It's funny how schizophrenic our society is when it comes to moral issues. We have various standards that we have for different people. And when you try to pin down what the morality of our nation is and our society is, it's like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. We have various standards for different people. There's the support for the freedom of expression, so that people's right to watch stuff on television that is very sexually explicit and immoral is seen as something that they should be able to do. And yet, if those same people act out what they're watching on television or in those movies, they're considered immoral bums. It's just a strange thing how in our society we really don't have a clear standard by which to live our lives. Now, in saying that, it's not to say that there are no standards. The reality is that there are many standards out there, and the problem is choosing the right one. For example, there's the standard that seems to be a fairly popular standard, and that is, if it feels good, do it. Seems like a fair number of people live by that standard. But the problem of that standard and many other standards is, like, moral standards are a little bit like a gimme in golf. I'm not a very good golfer, but that's why I happen to know about gimmes in golf. Those of you who are golfers probably know about that as well, but that is one of my great hopes when I play golf, is that whoever I play with believes in gimmies. Now, if you don't play golf, a gimme is just you hit the ball and you get it as close to the hole as you can, and then usually the person you're playing with says, ah, you'd get it anyway. That just take that and put it in and count it as a stroke. Now, that's not too bad. If you hit the ball about a half an inch from the hole, you can kind of figure, okay, he's very likely to hit it in the next stroke. The problem with a gimme is, when do you give your partner, your opponent, a gimme? When you're an inch from the hole? A foot from the hole? 5 feet from the hole? One of the things that I like about playing golf with Skip McGovern is that he lets me have gimmies that are practically halfway across the putting green. In fact, I've decided that I could keep up with any golfer. A professional golfer, I could keep up with any of them as long as the gimmies were big enough. And that's how many people's moral standards are. They're like gimmies. So they live by the standard of, if it feels good, do it. Well, what if what I do that feels so good to me causes somebody else a problem? What if it doesn't just offend them? What if it hurts them? Well, that standard just doesn't always work. It's not very objective. Like a gimme in golf, there's no way to say exactly how long it needs to be. So it seems like our society has then accepted another moral standard. And that is, it's okay, whatever you want to do is absolutely okay for you as long as nobody gets hurt. Now, I kind of think that that's the moral standard of the majority of people in America today. You do whatever you do as long as nobody gets hurt. But again, like a gimme, it lacks objectivity. Who determines whether somebody gets hurt? Do I make that determination? Because it's very easy when something seems like it works for me to not really notice how it affects you. And what happens if a whole bunch of us benefit, but a handful of people are hurt by it? What if just one person is hurt by it? What if that one person is an unborn child? I suppose we can decide that that's really not a real person, so it doesn't really matter. Whatever it is, you discover the objectivity of our morality makes it very difficult to decide what's right and what's wrong. Is there a standard that is more objective, that's not based on what I want to do or what you want to do, that goes beyond us? Well, for 4,000 years, there's been a standard that has been foundational for societies and nations. It has been the foundation for the Jews and for Christians. It is what some have called the Ten Words or the Decalogue. We know it best as the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are foundational to all of Scripture, really. You find them either alluded to directly or indirectly throughout major portions of Scripture. They're repeated in the Old Testament two times, in Exodus chapter 20 and in Deuteronomy chapter 5. Both places they're spelled out in detail. And when you turn the page of the Bible to the New Testament, you discover that most of the commands of these Ten Commandments are also repeated in the New Testament. Jesus repeats almost directly at least five of the Ten Commandments in the Gospels, and the Apostle Paul, as you read Romans and 1 Timothy, also speaks of these commands. So they're foundational in many ways. And yet, as much as many people will allude to the fact that these commands have been foundational to a great deal of our morality and our legislation throughout Western society, at least, it's interesting to me how few people really know the Ten Commandments. I mean, if you think about it, how many of the Ten Commandments can you name? I'm not going to have you do it at your table or put you on the spot, but my suspicion is probably even most of us who are Christians who would say we believe these commands can't name them all. I would guess, just a guess, that probably less than 1 in 1,000 people could give you all 10 of the Ten Commandments. Yet, it's the closest thing we have to some sort of standard that's outside of us. Now, maybe the reason that we aren't as familiar with them as we could be is because we're not totally comfortable with them. I mean, we know that they were taught as we were growing up in our homes or in our school or in our church. But, you know, it would be a little bit easier if they weren't commandments. Commandments sound so binding and so hard. It would be better if they're the 10 suggestions. Then we could just, okay, well, I don't really like that one. In fact, it'd be great if they were optional. You know, I'll choose 6 or 7 of them. But then again, we get back to the gimme. Which ones do you choose? Actually, I think one of the reasons we may not recognize how important these commandments are is because we don't understand the context in which they were given. Because the Ten Commandments were not given to squelch our fun, or because God is some kind of harsh God who doesn't like to see people enjoying themselves. The Ten Commandments, as you study the Old Testament, were given as a foundation for a nation, a foundation for a people of faith. In fact, in the context of the book of Exodus, which is where we're going to be looking at the Ten Commandments in the coming weeks, you discover that as the people of God prepared to receive these Ten Commandments from God, there was absolutely no solidarity among this group of probably 2.5 million people. Now, let me just refresh your memories for those of you who haven't thought about this in ages. But leading up to this point, God's people, the Jewish people, had been enslaved in Israel, in Egypt, for 400 years. And as slaves, finally, God raised up a deliverer by the name of Moses. And as you probably know, either from your Sunday school upbearing or from movies, Moses stands before Pharaoh and he says, "Let my people go." And Pharaoh, finally, after God had sent 10 plagues, allows the people to go. But at the last minute, he changes his mind and sends his armies after the Israelites. And one of the first experiences of these people as a nation is standing there before the Red Sea, with the Red Sea in front of them and Pharaoh's army coming after them, and realizing that they are sandwiched in a very difficult spot. But you also know that God worked one of the major miracles of the Old Testament. He parted the Red Sea so that the Jewish people could walk through, and when the invading army, the Egyptian army came, the waters closed in on them. I mean, it was an amazing thing. God had delivered these people. You would think that at that point they'd say, "God, whatever you say, we're going to do. And Moses, you've led us this far. We're on your side." That was in Exodus chapter 14. It's interesting that when you get to Exodus chapter 15, it's only been a few days since this great miracle has taken place. But when they get to the other side of the Red Sea, the people haven't had anything to drink in 3 days. And so in Exodus chapter 15, you discover that these people who've just been delivered in an amazing way have a very strange response. Verse 22 of chapter 15, "Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the desert of Shur. For 3 days they traveled the desert without finding water. And when they came to Marah, they could not drink the water because it was bitter. And so the people grumbled against Moses, saying, 'What are we to drink?'" There wasn't this, "Boy, Moses, you led us through the most difficult experience we've ever been through. We're trusting you." Maybe they trusted him on day one, maybe day two, but by day three, at least some of the people were starting to grumble. But God directed Moses, and Moses threw wood into this salty spring, and people were able to drink from it. God had once again intervened, and it seemed like now they were learning, you know, God can provide, we can trust Him. But they travel a little ways further, and it's about a month and a half later, and at the beginning of chapter 16, you discover that this time the people have been not without water, but without food. And this time it's not just a handful of people who grumble, it's the whole community. In verse 1 of chapter 16 of Exodus, the whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai on the 15th day of the second month after they'd come out of Egypt. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted, but you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death." It's fun being a leader. Moses was really enjoying it at that point in time. This fickle crowd, let's face it, they really weren't that much different than we are. I mean, I've seen it in my own life. I've seen it in our church. Maybe we're not ready to grumble against the church leadership, but isn't it amazing how we have seen in our church God provide tens of thousands of dollars to help us rebuild our church after the fire that we had 20 years ago. And yet, the next time there's a major financial crisis, we find ourselves thinking, how are we going to do this? Are we going to make it through this? What do we have to cut back? And we get panicky. I mean, even as a pastor, I on one hand, I know this. On another hand, I think, I'm not that much different than these people. It's easy to trust God when things are going well, but when things are not going so well, it's easy to complain or be frustrated or afraid. Anyway, once again, God intervenes and he sends manna and quail, food to provide for the people. Once again, he works a major miracle. And once again, you think, maybe now they've learned their lesson. They have. The next chapter, the beginning of the next chapter, they again find themselves thirsty. The whole Israelite community, verse 1 of chapter 17, set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at a place called Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. And they said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst?" Same song, third verse. This group of people had a common ancestry. They all had were children of Jacob, children of Israel. They had a common history. They'd been enslaved in Egypt. Jacob's son, Joseph, came down and invited the family down during a famine, and that family became a nation of 2.5 million people. And so they had all this history in common. But they really weren't a nation. They weren't really a unified family. They were just a bunch of people that had lived together in Egypt. What does it take to make a nation? Well, they were heading to the promised land, but they didn't yet have a land, and all they had was their past. What they really needed was something to bind them together. They needed a constitution. And that's really what the Ten Commandments are. They're a constitution for God's people so that they knew how they were supposed to live. And God gave them this not to ruin their fun, but to bind them together. Not so that he'd be hard on them, but so that they could know how to live in a way that pleased him and that worked well with one another. But before the people could accept these commands, they had to learn a few things practically. They had already learned, or at least the lessons had been taught, whether they learned it, that God could provide their physical needs. I mean, he'd provided when they had when they needed water, when they needed food, when they needed more water. God was always meeting their needs. In fact, when they finally come to the desert of Sinai, since it's a desert, I can only assume that they needed food and water again in a desert. And while chapter 19 doesn't tell us this, I assume that God, once again, as we turn to chapter 19, had provided for them physically. But before God could give them His commands, they needed to learn some spiritual lessons. One lesson they needed to learn was about the holiness of God. And as you read chapter 19, which leads into what God speaks to them, the commands that He gives to them in Exodus 20, you discover this experience in chapter 19 had to flavor their understanding of what God said to them in chapter 20. Because as God gets ready to give His commandments to the people, this constitution, this foundation for their lives and their moral behavior, He goes out of His way to help them see His holiness. In verse 10 of chapter 19, the Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow. Have them wash their clothes and be ready by the third day, because on that day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all His people." God says, "Moses, I want you to tell everybody to get ready. I'm going to meet with you. And I want everybody to have their clothes washed and their hands washed. They need to be physically clean." And that was really almost symbolic, that they needed to be more clean than that, inwardly as well as outwardly. But God didn't just stop there by having them to get ready physically and get washed up. The setting of these commands was absolutely awesome. As the people stood there a little ways away from Mount Sinai, God warned Moses, "Make sure you put limits around this mountain. Don't let anybody get too close. And if anybody does get too close, they're to be put to death." I mean, He's saying, this is a holy place. It is so holy that no one should get close to it. Talk about having the fear of God in people. It may seem overdone to us, but that's because we oftentimes minimize God's holiness. And not only does God warn Moses to put limits and keep people at a distance so that they're not struck dead, but look at what it says takes place on the mountain itself. Verse 14, "After Moses had gone down the mountain to the people, he consecrated them and washed their clothes, and then he said to the people, 'Prepare yourself for the third day. Abstain from sexual relations.' And on the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning and a thick cloud over the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. And then Moses led the people of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain." They've been told to this point, don't go near it. And now under Moses' guidance, you just have to figure. Imagine a mountain that practically seems like a volcano. I mean, it's shaking, there's smoke, there's fire. And Moses says, "All right, let's gather around it." That's not your normal reaction to a volcano. But this wasn't a volcano. This was God's presence on this mountain. And God was trying to impress upon these people His awesomeness and His holiness. And when God gives these people His commands, notice where Moses is. Because if you have approached this like I have, you kind of think, well, Moses went up there, God gave these commands on a tablet, which He did later on. But that's not when God gave the commandments the first time. Notice where Moses is. Verse 17, "Then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like the smoke from a furnace. The whole mountain trembled violently, and the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder. And then Moses spoke with the voice of God answering him. And the Lord descended to the top of Mount Sinai and called Moses to the top of the mountain. Moses has gone up. But he says, Moses, go down and warn the people that they're not supposed to force their way up. So Moses goes back down. Verse 23, Moses said to the Lord, the people cannot come up Mount Sinai because you yourself warned us, put limits around the mountain. The Lord replied, go down and bring Aaron up with you, but the priests of the people must not force their way through to come up to the Lord. He will break out against them. So Moses went down to the people and told them. So as they're anticipating God to speak, Moses has been up speaking to God up to the top of the mountain or somewhere near the top of the mountain. And God has sent Moses down. And it's when Moses is down with the people that these commands are given. And God spoke, chapter 20, spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but on the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son nor your daughter nor your manservant nor your maidservant nor your animals nor alien within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. But he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false witness, false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his manservant or maidservant, his ox or donkey or anything else that belongs to your neighbor. This wasn't Moses interpreting the law. This was God speaking the law. So how do you think the people felt after this volcanic experience of God's holiness and his glory on top of the mountain? Well, if you're not sure, it says verse 18, when the people saw the thunder and the lightning and heard the trumpet and saw the mountain in smoke, they trembled with fear. They stayed at a distance and said, Moses, speak to us yourself and we'll listen. But don't have God speak or we will die. I admit, most of us aren't comfortable with a God who is like that. But we don't have a choice. I mean, we may not be comfortable with it because we'd like to fashion a God like the Israelites like to fashion their gods into idol form that are just much more comfortable to us, that make fewer demands on us, that make us feel good about ourselves, that make us feel like we're the center of the universe. But this awesome God left no doubt that he was at the center of everything and that he was supposed to be at the center of their lives. And when he set these standards, it was the Creator giving standards for his human creation. God impressed upon the people his holiness. But did you notice one other thing that God did to spiritually prepare the people for these laws? Right before he gave the Ten Commandments, he reminded them of his deliverance. In verse 1 of Exodus 20, don't miss that. He says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. this holy God, as awesome as he is, as frightening as he can be at times, was also the God who had delivered his people. He was the one who had made it possible for them to get away from the Egyptians and open the Red Sea and provided food and provided water when they needed it. He was the God who had delivered them. In fact, it's important to recognize, and I think we oftentimes miss this, that when we think about the Ten Commandments, so many Christians, and certainly many non-Christians as well, see the Ten Commandments as foundational for our relationship with God. That if I keep these commandments, then somehow I can earn God's favor. But that's not how it worked for God's people in the book of Exodus. God had already delivered his people. He'd already taken them out of Egypt. He'd already chosen them. He had already rescued them. And then he gives his laws for them to follow. People today and people for centuries have gotten this backward and feel like we have to keep these laws in order to please God. If anything should be evident from this perspective of God and his awesomeness and his holiness, we can't stand before a holy God. No matter how much we wash our hands or wash our clothes, the filthiness in our lives is still there. So the Ten Commandments are not there to give us a foundation by which we approach God. For God's people, it was their response to God, how they were supposed to live, because they had been chosen by him. They'd been delivered by him. And that same thing is true for us as God's people today. If you know Jesus Christ as your Savior, the Apostle Paul said to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 20, he said, "You have been bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God with your bodies." Because you have experienced the fact that God came into this world in the person of Jesus Christ, and he died for you, and he gave his life for you so that you could have a relationship with him, that's the reason to follow him. Peter wrote to the people in his day, and he said that you are a chosen people, a royal race, a holy nation, a people for God's possession, so that you may declare the excellencies of him who called you. We've already been chosen by God, have been made his people, and it's out of that, out of his grace, that we're commanded to live this way. So what does this mean to us? How do these commandments apply to us today? Some of you may remember that in Jesus' day, there was a teacher of the law, a lawyer, who came to Jesus. And he said, "Jesus, tell me what the greatest of the commands are." And Jesus thought not just of these Ten Commandments, but of all of the teachings of the Old Testament. He said, really, there are two. He said, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and strength and mind. And love your neighbor as yourself." But how do you do that? I mean, how do you? It sounds good to say love God, but how do you love God? Well, that's what I think the Ten Commandments are about. They are not a foundation by which we have a relationship. They're an expression of our relationship. They show us how we are to love God and to love our neighbor. When you think about the commandments, they're all about that, about how you love God and how you love your neighbor. The first four commandments are directly about how you love God. You're not to have any other gods before him. He takes first place. You're not to worship any idols. He is to be the one who is worshipped above everyone else. There is only one God who is to be followed, and his name is to be revered. Don't take his name in vain. We, by how we live and how we talk, we want to make sure that we honor his name. And then as we worship, we need to set aside a day, a time, to worship God, to keep Him central in our lives. The first four commandments are about how do you love God? Very tangibly, how does this work out? And then the fifth commandment really is kind of a little bit of both, because it has to do with your parents. As parents, we have a responsibility to communicate our faith to our children. So in some ways, we are the bridge from God to our children. But we're also the foundation of our relationship with society. So we love our society by having a priority in loving our parents. We honor life. We don't murder. We honor God by honoring marriages. We don't commit adultery. We don't interfere with another relationship. We honor God by honoring people's property. We don't steal. We honor God by honoring people's integrity. We don't slander their names. And we honor people by wanting what is best for them rather than what is their best. We don't want their stuff. We want what's best for them. We don't covet. We put them first. The point in all that is these commands, as we look at them, are an expression of how we can love God and how we can love others. Not a foundation that obligates God to love us. He already loves us. He's already sent His Son to die for you. All He asks you to do, if you've never accepted His Son, is He said, look, I've given you a gift that offers you a relationship with Me. If you just accept that gift, that's all you have to do. But then, in an expression of gratitude and thanksgiving, we show our love to Him by following His commands. After World War I, General Pershing wanted to have a victory parade across Europe. And to have this parade, Pershing set a kind of an arbitrary standard that the people who could march in this parade were soldiers who measured 1 meter, 86 centimeters in height. Well, much like us, the soldiers in Pershing's command weren't exactly sure how high 1 meter, 86 centimeters was. So when the news about the parade came along, Slim said to Shorty, well, you won't be marching in this parade. But the reality was, when they started recognizing that nobody knew exactly how high 1 meter, 86 centimeters was, somebody finally said, we need to get a real measuring stick. So somebody finally went into town and got a meter and measured everybody. And they discovered that in this one battalion, there was nobody who was 1 meter, 86 centimeters in height. In some ways, God's commands are like General Pershing's order. His standard is up here, and we're all down here. Now, you may be taller than me, I may be taller than you, you may be more moral than me, I may be able to follow a command better than you. But all of us fall short of that standard. The Ten Commandments are not a study to show us how to have a relationship with God. That only comes through God's grace in the person of Jesus Christ. And if you're here today and you know, you've gone to church most of your life and it's always been about performance and being good enough, the bad news is you can't be good enough. But the good news is that God has already provided a way in His grace by sending His Son to die for you. And if you've trusted Him, then like Paul, I say, honor God with your bodies because you have been bought with a price. Love God with your heart and soul and strength and mind. And the way you do that is spelled out in these commands that we're going to look at and study and discuss together. Do you want to love God? Do you want to be the person that He has called you to be in society? Then it's worth your while and my while to spend some time looking at these Ten Commands. I trust you'll be excited to grab a book and join a small group and show up here on Sunday morning so that we can talk about these things together. Would you pray with me?